and welcome to the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. I'm Phil Brining, and this week I was joined by Tristan Mills to talk through a load of stuff in the news. Hello, Tris.
Hello, Phil. How are you doing?
Yeah, good, thanks. I thought it was a great session, that one. It flowed really well. We had loads of stuff to talk about. What did you think? Or I'm just being biased, am I?
No, the moment we started, it was over. You know,
I know,
think
it flew.
It's an hour, not long enough.
I don't know. And my glasses worked this week as well, which was even better.
Yeah, you weren't pulling funny faces at the camera.
No, was I last week?
Maybe.
I'll have to be back and see. So let's see, what did we talk about? We spent a lot of time talking about the ICO findings on the police service in Northern Ireland, didn't we? I mean, I was really interested to talk through what we find on our audits, what they found on their audits, and kind of benchmark where, you know, organisations seem to be and whether we think that's, you know, progressed enough or not. That was, I think, quite a good conversation.
Yeah, it really was. It was quite interesting to see that what we found in our audits is very similar to what the ICO kind of found doing this audit for Northern Ireland Police Force.
Yeah, the consensual audit. I mean, the thing that we spoke about last, we didn't intentionally give it 6 minutes, but we talked about the new access to information scheme that's affecting registered housing providers. And I think this, we're going to have to keep coming back to this. This is new law that is going to affect that sector. So in my mind, that's all information rights law, which is, of course, you know, the branch of law that we practice in. That was quite a good discussion, but, you know, super quick, really. And so we didn't really, probably should have mentioned that a bit earlier on, but we were engrossed in other things, weren't we?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think it's going to require probably a whole podcast dedicated again to it, especially when it finally gets published and implemented.
Yeah. What else did we talk about? A few bits about, it's interesting, we talked about the Microsoft advised that Teams messages are now kind of a phishing attack vector. So people receiving phishing attacks via Teams messages, ransomware often. So that's something that everyone ought to be aware of. And we talked through the Mimecast report on the state of email security, and quite alarmingly they've noticed that there's a growth in emails still and a growth in phishing events and a growth in ransomware, but kind of a change in the sectors on the size of organizations that seem to be being targeted. Again, that was quite a good talk through that, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was. I mean, in general, I think a lot we also discussed was a lot of the cyber attacks that have just been happening and the vulnerabilities that organizations are facing. It seems to be growing ever more so every week.
Yeah. Now, we talked about CCTV, didn't we, as well, in toilet areas and in both schools and industrial settings. We got some quite good response for that. It was lovely to have Kathy on talking through, you know, something that she'd spoke to somebody about. But that prompted us into a discussion about, you know, what could the ICO, you know, do about this? Because they seem to be commenting in the press that it's not unlikely to be lawful, but yet that seems to be the extent of what they're prepared to do about it, unless there's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, the other part as well that I wonder is what's the, you know, what is the lawful basis? What is their necessity? How are they arguing this? Are they getting, you know, consent, not consent, opinions from, you know, the other, from the data subjects, or in this case, for the schools, the children, for employees, you know, not from the employees, from the organizations, the employees. So, yeah, there's a lot of really interesting kind of spinning plates regarding CCTV in bathrooms.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Indeed. Now, we haven't got time. There was loads of other stuff we talked about and loads of other stuff we wanted to talk about. And that hour just flew by, didn't it? And I think we'll have a chance to see what we can talk about next week. But then every week there's more and more news stories, isn't it? It's brilliant. So what a brilliant time. There's stuff every day in the press, the mainstream press. There's you know, stuff about data protection or cybersecurity. It's you know, not good, because most of it's bad news. But
yeah, there's, you know, two ways you can kind of look at it. Great, raising awareness. Companies, we're seeing, you know, they're changing their posture. They really want to make sure that they're more compliant. On the flip side, you know, people's personal data is, you know, sadly being compromised. But, yeah, you know, overall, I think, though, you know, the more awareness, the more we can raise on this, the better. You know, just hopefully we'll get organizations to really improve their posture around this.
Yeah, and that kind of leads us full circle to, you know, and then when we're doing, you know, audits and compliance checks, you know, we really ought to be seeing some improvement, you know, these days in the level of assurance we gain from the places we're going to, you know, the ICO, me, you, anybody else that's doing these kind of assessments. But at the moment, you know, we've made some progress since 2018, but it's to me, it seems to have aren't flattered, and there needs to be another impetus to get people to, you know, just do more in all those in all those areas.
Yeah, I'm just kind of being a cheerleader for the ISOs to go saying, go on, take the ball, run the 9 yards, you can do it. Lead.
lead. That's something Dave shouts in the office, isn't it? Anyway, listen, without further ado, then let's let people dive into the this week's session. So if you object to, hello, Carl, if you object to the recording, then, you know, please let us know and we'll see what we can do after the recording. So, this is one of the features I like, Tris, which I say this many times about the PCIDSS, is as an assessor, qualified assessor, you have to go through formal training every year. And there's a 354 slide presentation deck, which took me virtually all day yesterday to work through. I mean, it's absolutely mind-numbingly tedious. It's horrendous. And you have to go through it all, and then when you finish the last slide, it says, right, you finished the course, now you can go and do your exam. But then you have to go and do an exam, a 90-minute exam. And I think this is a really good thing, you know, even if you forget the exam bit, but having, you know, data protection officers go through formal annual training, I think it's a good thing. I think it would be a good thing.
So if that was the case, who do you think would design the training, or do you think it would be like the same way that a lot of IT certifications, where you just have an accredited body, or do you think the ICO should develop something?
Well, I think the ICO would probably contract that out to a number of people. I mean, you know, we've got our own DPO course, and we could say, well, you know, there's a requirement to do an annual refresher training on it. But unless everybody else does the same thing, then people are going to say, oh, no, that sounds far too hard. You know, it's always like it's, but it's a good thing. You know, I focused this year when I was doing the training. Can I go through the training? It took me all day, partly because I dived off down various tangents to do some research and reading around the subjects, which, again, it's just a good time. It's only one day a year, right? But it's just a really good time to have a look at that. And I was looking yesterday in particular encryption and hashing methodologies, just because I know that's a question that always comes up in the exam. And I just wanted to read more about it, to be honest, and see what the current state of thinking was. But it's a good thing. It's a good thing, I think. Anyway, so yeah, I've been super busy this week doing a whole host of different things, including that. But also, you know, there's been a lot in the news, hasn't there, this week?
Yeah. It's been like that for the past like 2-3 weeks, hasn't it? We've just seemed to have lots of different breaches and similar sectors, and just lots of news kind of constantly coming out.
Yeah, so we want to talk about some breaches today. And I also want to pick up on the audit that the ICO's done of the police service in Northern Ireland. I want to talk about that because currently in the middle of auditing with Esther on a range of different clients, and I just want to compare and contrast what we're finding when we're auditing. There's something I really have to flag up as well, which I sent an internal message around our business, that there's quite a few warnings of phishing campaigns that use Teams messages now as the carrier for the message rather than email. So that seems to be a growing thing. So you just sent me a Teams message with a link to an app on it, you know, but it's those types of things, links, attachments, downloads, that are attack vectors. So I want to talk a bit about that. I want to talk about some changes in the law, potentially. So changes to the definition of fundamental rights and freedoms on our safety bill. And we've been digging out this week a bit more on the access to information scheme for social housing providers. So that might be worth talking about. And then there's a few bits about, you know, mass data collection, fertility apps the ICO is looking at, and health data, you know, Fitbits and the like. So, and then we've got a massive array of other stuff, CCTV in school toilets, you know, there's a whole load of other stuff we want to talk about. Where should we start? Should we start with the police? Is that
Yeah, I think that's been the common theme for the past, again, about month, 2 months.
Well, there's been a lot of them. So we spoke a few weeks ago about, there was the Met Police, the Cumbria Police, the Norfolk Police, the Suffolk Police, the Police Service Northern Ireland, and now yesterday was it, the Greater Manchester Police.
Yeah, so effectively what's happened is one of their third party suppliers that produces like ID cards and warrant cards got attacked, which has released, I don't think we've got a quantitative number, but effectively has released a lot of police data from the Greater Manchester Police.
Oh, right. OK, I thought is it a ransomware attack and there's a threat of releasing it, or is it actually being released out?
No, I think it is a ransomware attack. Apologies. Yeah. So but either way, we know that this information has gotten out. We just don't know what the
Yeah, currently. But this is, to me, it seems really similar to the Met Police attack a few weeks ago, which again was warrant cards, access passes. And we spoke then that, you know, theoretically, if you can access the data in that way, you could presumably create fake warrant cards and access passes.
Yeah, yeah, and what I wonder though is, so the third party company that's had this cyber attack and whatnot, I wonder if they decided to, I don't know, look at their posture after the first attack with a different police organisation.
Well, it's a great question, isn't it? It's a great question. This firm, apparently, according to the BBC report I read, is in Stockport. So I don't know whether it's a national supplier, but this is, again, supply chain risk, isn't it? Supply chain risk all the way through, you know. So, yeah, you'd think, I suppose you'd think that that would, you know, the Met Police attack would prompt the GMP to say, well, oh, maybe we ought to have a look at that. But I can't imagine that happens. You would think of the number of people that do audits. Again, this is being my bonnet about audits and compliance checks. Yeah, there's so few and far between and irregular that I can't imagine it would trigger that kind of response.
I just remember when the Log4j stuff that happened a couple of years ago now, working in public university, and when that happened, that was the first question, what's our posture, what's our position? And during that time, there was other universities that got had huge cyber attacks, and our kind of audit and risk committee, as well as kind of the higher up people, the executives, they wanted to know, are we in the same position as that, and if so, how do you know we've got to get out of it? So yeah. That's kind of where my head goes. I'm thinking, well, you know we've had a police the Met Police have a very similar attack. If I was in a police, if I was a police station or whatever, I'd be thinking, right, well, actually, let's make sure that doesn't happen. Probably we need to go and speak to, our third party suppliers and probably do an audit check on them.
Yeah,
so that's where my head goes.
yeah, exactly. But what did the uni actually do there? I mean, when you say, oh, have we got the same kind of attack surface, or, you know, are we in, what's our posture like? What happened? I mean, did they ring IT and IT? Yeah, we're fine. Don't worry about it. Or was there actually some kind of
there was a lot of movement. trying to think of how much I can actually say in this scenario, but effectively, I just remember working over Christmas because they pulled everyone in and we had to do, you know, server sweeps, making sure what the position was, and ones that, you know, if they were to have this particular line of code to shut them down and kind of extract them from our network and effectively sort them out and make sure that they were going to be, you know, not only compliant but secure when they were brought back online. It was quite a significant thing. It was, that's what I will say. I don't think I could say that, much.
That's good. I mean, it's better than a quick Teams message to the head of IT saying, what's this crack? And he says, don't worry about it, we're fine, which is, maybe I'm overly cynical there, Tris.
That kind of does happen, and it's one of those. Luckily, you know, I had a really good team. I had a very good kind of collaborative efforts with the IT team. So it was quickly escalated to the right, to the right stakeholders, which was really good.
Yeah, good. Now, on the police service in Northern Ireland, Rich, I kind of haven't really followed it for the last few weeks. So I was surprised to Google it this morning and find that a man had been arrested, an IT supplier had been arrested for having a copy of the spreadsheet on his phone. So he's currently being released on bail, but it was 2 days ago, or 12th of September, he was arrested and charged in connection with terrorist offences. But I think from what I've read, and I'm not up to speed with it, it looks like the courts have said currently we don't think there's any kind of case to answer, but I wasn't aware of that somebody had been arrested. Wow. not for breaching but for
having that
the
information
data,
yeah that's and really
his defense said, well, look, thousands of people have got this, yeah, you know, why have you picked on this chap?
But I think I just remember when all this news was breaking out about how, you know, the kind of terrorist levels and the risk involved, I think they're very what's the word? Scared? Might be a bit too harsh. Might be appropriate. You know, if you've got this information on your phone, why do you have it? Which is a bit weird because that kind of leads into, you know, you're guilty by association of having this information.
Yeah. Apparently he got it. It was in a WhatsApp group where it was distributed.
So they're going to go around and arrest all the people in the WhatsApp group.
who knows? who knows? But I mean, more interestingly, I think from my point of view, is that the ICO has very quickly, I have to say, carried out a consensual audit now of the Police Service of Northern Ireland. And they only looked at two areas, looked at accountability and governance, and looked at data sharing. And they made 60 recommendations, which is quite a lot. And 11 of those were quite urgent recommendations. But what was, I have to say, was very, very surprising to me was the kind of eight areas that the ICO has picked up on as the key improvements. This is all, you know, publicly available information. If you look at the ICO's website, you know, the report summary is there. I'd love to actually find the audit report itself, but that's not there. But, you know, the things that were found to be, well, either needing improvement or, you know, not compliant, and bearing in mind there's 11 of these 60 is urgent, and there is 42 of the recommendations a high priority. Those are things that were not right, were ROPAs, right? So not you know, the ROPAs not there, no process for formally reviewing periodically the ROPAs. And they've recommended doing a detailed mapping exercise, data mapping exercise for all information. So that suggests to me there's either no ROPA there, or that the ROPA that there is there has got big holes in it and not comprehensive enough. Another area that they found, I'll kind of come back to this, I'm going to kind of throw them out then, I'll come back to this. Well, there's apparently no documentation of lawful basis for processing and no appropriate policy documents in place, you know, for special criminal convictions data. So that was, again, a bit of a surprise. I'm picking on a few here, no DPAA process or no DPAA templates, no kind of view as to, or guidance as to who can sign off on certain, you know, levels of risk. And another area which picked up twice was training. So training staff haven't been trained in the organizational processes sufficiently to enable them to perform their tasks and responsibilities. Again, that's one of the points. The second point was, in general, information governance training, you know, just not really there or not good enough. And then finally, kind of, there are a couple others, but finally to highlight data sharing. You know, they're recommending a review of data sharing, which suggests that there aren't data sharing agreements in place, they're not documented, and so on and so forth. And the other one, actually, there's only one more I haven't mentioned, is kind of a handover process when information asset owners change. You know, so somebody hands over information asset ownership to somebody else. You know, there's no process for that. People don't understand that they're responsible for them. There's no guidance and no training. Now, you know, we're in the middle of doing a load of audits, Esther and I, for some clients. And I'm afraid these are exactly the kind of things that we find in all of our audits without fail.
It kind of blows my mind. And I think I mentioned this when all these kind of breaches were happening a couple of weeks ago. But I do look at the ICO and say, you know, this is happening across the board. There needs to be something. There clearly needs to be some kind of change to get not just these public authorities, but companies to realize that how important and, you know, these tasks are.
39 years of data protection law in the UK, and 5 years of the GDPR. I'm still always surprised that, you know, organisations are in this position. You know, what we usually find when we're auditing is there's something in most areas, but everything's got holes in it. You know, like ROPAs either don't exist, or where they do exist, they haven't got the right structure, or there's bits that are missing in the you know, usually on an Excel sheet, you know, there's cells that have got nothing in them, or what they've got is gibberish, like lawful basis processing is completely made up rather than, you know, something from Article 6.
And then you look at kind of that aspect, and you think, well, then how can your privacy policy be correct? How are you achieving the other principles of GDPR? How are you being, you know, lawfulness and fairness and transparent? These are core elements, core activities that companies must do. And without completing them, how are you achieving GDPR at all?
Well, and you know, it's really just frustrating, really, for me anyway, as a privacy practitioner, and it may well be for everybody else who listens to this, that, you know, that there isn't sufficient weight put into or put behind the, you know, the importance of compliance checking on a periodic basis, independent assessors coming in, either, you know, pay someone to come in or do a swap with a similar organization, you know, but, you know, unless we measure something and report on it, it ain't going to change.
Yeah, and I think, you know, go back to what you were mentioning about PCI, about making mandatory training and mandatory kind of reporting and whatnot. It kind of falls into that kind of category. We might talk about this, you know, later on, you know, throughout this podcast. But the NCSE and the ICO have released an article that basically says, you know, if you've had a breach, if you report that breach and not, it, you know, being discovered by us through not reporting it, we will fine you less. Great, but again, it doesn't feel like it feels like more of a as an option rather than you must do this.
Yeah,
and that's where I kind of read this, and I just think, you know, what is the ICO going to do to? I don't want to say set an example, but you know, I feel like that's the terminology that kind of comes to my head, to make other organizations, other police stations, other, you know, public authorities, private companies, charities, everything realize that this is, you know, a mandatory exercise you must do and you must have these processes in.
Yeah, I mean, they've done what they, you know, they've done some of, you know, what they can. They've produced the accountability framework, they've produced some guidance, you know, this, again, they've done bits, but, you know, and they are fining organizations, but not really for GDPR transgressions, for PECA transgressions, you know, and you know they've got powers to punish, you know, company directors and company officers within the Data Protection Act, but I don't think they've used those powers yet. But
I think the only one that I know that's been used was one time in Germany, and I think that was quite a recent one. But that I believe is the only time that any commissioner or regulatory
I think you're right, yeah,
but he's done it,
yeah. But what I liked about the ICO's approach, again, we take this approach well in our audit reports, is they talk about assurance, you know, so there's a limited assurance, a high level of assurance. And we do the same, you know, I say to people, you know, I did an audit probably a year ago, and, you know, these people had nothing in place at all for rights requests. You know, they didn't know what one was, they didn't have a register, didn't have a policy, didn't have a procedure, you know, nothing at all. You know, but there was no evidence that they received a rights request. So in theory, you know, they're compliant. They haven't not complied with the law. But, you know, what level of assurance did we have that if they got one of these things, they would treat it properly? Zero, you know. So interesting. Anyway, sorry.
I was just going to say, I think that is like the right approach, because it is much more of a kind of risk-based approach. Instead of saying you are compliant or you're not compliant, is very much of, well, if this happened, what posture would you be in? What position would you be put in?
Yeah, so kind of what confidence have we got that you're able to demonstrate compliance now? And what confidence have we got that you're going to remain compliant if you are compliant, or get to compliance if you're not compliant? And that's kind of the approach we take. But, I mean, unfortunately, there's such a lot of the areas we look at. The only area that people actually do usually give us some good level of confidence is in IT security. But that's not because they've put in place from a data protection legislation perspective. It's in place, you know, for other reasons, and it's products that have been purchased, and, you know, there's different budgets for that, there's different routines for that, you know, all this other stuff, you know, the obligations under the GDPR, processes, DPAs, etc. It's usually, you know, very poorly put together and policed.
Yeah, completely agree.
Anyway, enough about it, enough ranting, stop ranting, Trist. Now, I don't know if you saw that Airbus had a breach as well. Again, this I think was a supplier. Yeah, it was a Turkish airline that had access to the Airbus portal, and somehow this Turkish airline had tried to install an unauthorized version of the Microsoft.NET framework on a computer, and that had been compromised, and that got back into the Airbus systems. Now, the Airbus obviously as a very large aerospace company effectively say that hasn't affected any of their kind of defense secret type work, but, you know,
I find that this kind of stuff, you know, it without having kind of a forensic approach to it, you don't know until it's kind of too late, really.
Yeah, no, that's right. Yeah, now I mentioned earlier that Microsoft have issued warnings about a new type of phishing campaign targeting organizations via Teams messages. Now, I'd not heard of this before, and I suppose I probably obviously don't read enough, because it seems fairly logical, doesn't it? But interestingly, Mimecast have released a report on the state of email security, I think just today actually, which I've downloaded and I skimmed through it, and they're saying that the volume of emails has gone up since the pandemic. It's like 82%, you know, higher than it was, or something along those lines. So quite a large increase in the volume of emails. And also they're saying that the primary attack vector for bad actors is via email, but they're recognizing that there are some new threat surfaces, and instant messaging teams is one of those they've recognized as being, you know, growing. So Microsoft's saying that attachments to Teams messages, you know, there's a way of infiltrating the Teams network and sending malicious Teams messages with a malicious payload in them. So when you click on the attachment, then it'll kind of launch some malicious code. So again, I think everyone absolutely has to be aware of that, because it might be an area that is not on the radar.
Yeah, and I think right now, you know, if I was in your position, Phil, if I was the owner of the company, I would be saying to people, you know, don't open up, you know, anything that's coming through Teams, and trying to get some policies in place just to try and, you know, make sure that these incidents don't happen. That's probably the best way of treating it. If they could already kind of infiltrate through Teams, there's possibly a technical issue there, and that might be to do with Microsoft. And right now, this is where you've got to really have effective training and policy to ensure that your staff, you know, are aware of the risks and don't do that effectively.
Yeah, and tools, you've got to deploy what tools you can, you know, intrusion detection tools and so on and so forth. Yeah. So I thought that was worth raising. Now, on the Mimecast, you might not have had a chance to read the Mimecast report, State of Email Security, but they were saying, again, this is quite worrying, that cyber criminals are continuing to refine and you know, change and adapt their strategies, and that, you know, phishing, I think, is still the biggest. There's 255 million phishing attempts apparently in 2022, which is 61% higher than prior year, which is a big increase, isn't it? But they're saying that, you know, worryingly, more than 70% of the emails was opened. So, you know, we've all got anti-phishing filters and things on our email, but it looks like, you know, they can be circumnavigated quite easily.
Yeah. You know, it's constantly a cat and mouse game, isn't it? You know, as we develop our defenses and our ways to kind of prevent these phishing emails, you know, the people on the other end, they're going to constantly develop how they're going to, their approach. And kind of now with AI becoming more and more advanced, it's going to be more and more aggressive, I think, these attacks. And we're seeing that, you know, across the board.
Yeah. I think the survey was of 1,750 senior IT professionals, 715 different organizations. That's just quite a relatively large sample, not on a global scale, I suppose, but
still a healthy number to make a very good kind of, I don't know, guesstimate of what the direction and where it's kind of, you know, going.
Yeah.
I think it just kind of comes back down to having really effective training to your staff, making them very much aware. I think one of the biggest issues I've seen when, you know, being a DPO in the past and whatnot, is training is so boring and people just kind of flick through and not care, but they don't realize that this stuff is really, really important. And, you know, we're getting more and more clever, or not we are, but they are getting more clever on how they're doing these attacks.
Yeah. Now, I know you've just had a pop at me for my comments earlier about my PCI DSS QSA training. I was saying how boring it was. I persevered with it, and actually it acted as a springboard for me to go off and investigate further some concepts. But yes, it isn't necessarily the most interesting thing, is it? Sorry, I've got a frog in my throat.
No worries. I mean, I think there's a difference between mandatory training for all staff and a PCI training that is quite probably very in detailed, and a training that takes you all day to go through.
Yes, maybe so. Now, what was worrying for me in this report as well is that it seems to be that the ransomware kind of, it's broken kind of attack into phishing, ransomware, and spoofing. And it's saying that they seem to be targeting, the criminals seem to be targeting smaller companies now for ransomware. So, you know, I think what they've found is that bigger companies have hardened their systems to this. And anybody, you know, companies with 250 to 500 employees, they're saying they've got a much higher instance now of reporting ransomware attacks than the bigger companies and the smaller brackets. So, you know, we're not quite in that bracket, but we're definitely a small business. But that's just a shift as well, which I think, again, we ought to be really aware of.
Yeah, there was an incident that happened to an IT YouTuber, but this was a phishing attack that they got. And what happened was effectively the attacker sent them a bill or somewhat, and they opened it, thinking it was a perfectly normal thing. Again, this was a IT security kind of YouTube, and their entire YouTube got hacked, not and the other channels and whatnot. And what effectively happened was, I believe they got the cash. That's how they attacked them. So they got over the multi-factor authentication, and they kept changing literally live, you know, all their YouTube videos and whatnot. It was a really an aggressive attack with, like I said, multi-factor authentication, all these other security measures. And it just shows how clever these phishing attacks are becoming, and how you've really got to have really robust mechanisms in place. And on the flip side, if an employee who has done all the training and is very aware, even if they do open up and do install malware, it shouldn't be kind of a quote-unquote kind of punishment to them, but it should be an eye-opener to, you know, executives and an IT team that, you know, these attacks are being aggressive and that we need to develop training even further.
Yeah, you're quite right. Yeah. Spoofing as well seems to be another serious risk, but it's what they found in the Mimecast report is that the public sector seems to be more affected by spoofing than others. But I mean, I have to say that I would have thought 5 years ago we were staggered to find a mirror copy of our website somewhere else, absolutely identical copy. Somebody had copied our website and published on a different domain. I can't remember what it was called, but it was our website, all my blogs, everything. But, you know, somebody else's domain. It was like, so, you know, we got it taken down. But, you know, that was, you know, we've been the victim of web domain spoofing in the past, which was, you know, a company of our size, which is surprising.
Yeah. Well, it's so easy. Well, I say it's so easy, but to these people, you know, it's just another day at the office, isn't it? And like I said, with AI and whatnot, you know, they're going to be quicker, they're going to be faster, and they're going to be more intelligent how they do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I read something else I've read this week in Lexology is kind of the a little article on the insider threat, you know, being the biggest threat. And interesting that it's kind of broke insider threat down into three different types of individual: a negligent insider, you know, a current or former employee, could be a contractor or a partner. It unintentionally causes damage by making a mistake or being the victim of a phishing scam or some social engineering. So the negligent insider, the malicious insider, kind of departed disgruntled employee who intentionally causes damage for their own, you know, personal gain. And an infiltrator, an external perpetrator, kind of a credential thief who kind of targets internal users' names and passwords to get unauthorized access. But, you know, it's quite interesting when you start thinking in those terms and breaking the insider threat down into those three categories. You know, then you can then start to address them, I think. You know, a negligent insider, you know, that's something systems and training and so on and so forth, awareness raising, might help to mitigate some of that threat. You know, malicious insider, segmenting things, you know, multi-factor authentication, maybe breaking you know, important tasks down into multiple parts so that you haven't got a single point of failure, you know, where possible. But again, that was quite an interesting quick read.
Yeah, and I guess for your infiltrator, you know, someone who's kind of come in, you know, who's a thief, I guess that's going to be a vetting process, isn't it? You know, you're checking up on them and whatnot. So it is really interesting. And yeah, I think categorizing it allows companies to develop strategies to ensure that, you know, they mitigate the risks involved with this.
Yeah. What have you seen then in the news you think is worth kind of highlighting?
Oh, well, I think it's worth talking about the CCTV in the toilets in schools.
Yeah, we've had this before. We've raised before. I have to say we've raised with some degree of surprise schools putting CCTV in the toilets. And we've had people on here coming on saying, no, we've got them in our school toilets, which, again, it is a surprise to me that they're in there. But this is a school in Sussex, isn't it? Is it in Sussex?
Yeah,
Sussex.
Yes. And just to kind of get everyone up to speed on the story, effectively, a school has put CCTV cameras into toilets for the pupils. And what they claim is that the scope, shall we say, or what they are recording is where effectively they kind of wash their hands. Parents are now furious. This was installed, I believe, over the summer. And parents are now furious and some want to pull out their children, while other parents have kind of supported this and said that, you know, this could help reduce potential bullying, or, you know, helping children keep safe or where they are if they're skiving off from school. So it's interesting. I would like to see, I'm not sure if this is a public school or private school, because if it's a public school, I would possibly throw in a FOIA and ask, you know, how did they come up to this decision? You know, if they could release their impact assessment or, you know, their GDPR kind of policies and documents around this and how they've come to the decision of this.
No, it's called the Sea Haven Academy. I'm just Googling it now. It's a secondary school in East Sussex. I suspect it's probably not an independent school, but I might be wrong. It's a multi-academy trust, part of a multi-academy trust. So I should imagine it's not an independent school. I would have thought it'd be state maintained, I would have thought.
So,
but I mean, sorry, go on.
I was going to say, you could then probably ask for that documentation then.
that's quite a good idea. Now, I was interested, I think this is a BBC story. I was interested that the ICO is kind of, what do you call it? Cited, reference. The ICO is referenced as saying that CCTV shouldn't be put up in school, in toilets, you know, and it shouldn't be running in areas considered private, such as toilets and changing rooms. And using CCTV here wouldn't usually be fair or proportionate, meaning it wouldn't be compliant with the data protection law. Except in exceptional cases, such as when dealing with repeated serious antisocial behaviour, it may be necessary to install surveillance in these private areas, but strong justification is needed and people must be aware they're being filmed. So this is back to your point, really, Tris, about, you know, what teeth have the ICO got? So,
yeah,
you know, there's this issue, there's this complaint, they're making a comment. What are they going to do about it? Is that the end of their responsibility? Well, we've commented in the press, you know, it's up to the school now to take it forward. Yeah. Surely that's not the end of the story.
Yeah, can I ask a question? So I've just recently been told that a grown adult in a manufacturing company, which I'm not going to say what it is, they've actually put CCTV in their toilets, and it's to check that people are not taking longer breaks. No informing, no signs, no nothing at all. We've had slight dealings with these, Phil, so I'm not going to mention
it. I know exactly what it is.
But it's absolutely horrendous, and people are complaining, and they're literally just ignoring them. Sports places, you know, like, for example, when they're filming supports, you know, when they're playing rugby and they film the dressing room areas, again, they're not being asked. So yeah, I just don't know how people think it's the right thing to do without, you know, permissions.
Yeah, well, there's a number of different points to raise. You, it's a good, great point, Kathy, thank you for that. But, you know, privacy notices is one of them, isn't it? You know, informing people that this is going on. But before you even get to that point, surely, you know, there should be a DPIA, a risk assessment of, you know, and what's the lawful basis of processing? Presumably legitimate interests. So where's the legitimate interest assessment? Where's the balancing?
Yeah, where's the necessity? It was the necessity and whatnot. You know, have you got the opinions of the of the data subjects? I mean, it's crazy.
They've also actually got the CCTV app on the phone, so the managers can see when somebody's visiting the toilet too many times or et cetera, et cetera. It's absolutely outrageous. But yeah, it's even worse than what we thought.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, in that legitimate interest assessment and the DPIA, you would expect to see some kind of argument and rationale around, you know, the necessity for the person, because you quite rightly say, Tris, you know, why is it? Is that the only way of tracking people away from their desk?
Yeah.
No, you know, no. So why are we using this particular method?
Very invasive method.
Cheap and easy, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, again, I'm going to get back on my soap box and make my rant, I guess. But I look at then to the ICO and said, look, you've clearly made a statement where you said, reading between the lines, you know, there has to be very much explicit, you know, explicit reasons of why you're going to do this. Clearly, the schools and lots of other organizations aren't meeting those reasons. What are you going to do about it? Because unless you act about it and enforce it, nothing's going to happen.
No, you're quite right. You know, it's all right making a public statement. Oh, this isn't right.
Yeah.
You know, do something about it.
It's great that you're looking like the hero, but actually, you know, you need to do, you know, what you say you're going to do.
Yeah. I mean, Vaughan's made a good point again that, you know, policy. So, you know, you would expect to see some kind of CCTV policy, you know, a policy statement, and then maybe some procedures around how to go about selecting, you know, where you're going to site it, how to go about selecting what kit you're going to put in, what kind of capabilities you've got. Now, I've said before that, and I was astounded when I was working at Everton. This is like 2008. And the quality of the cameras in the football stadium, you know, we had HMRC, we had all sorts of people in the police box at various games. And, you know, the quality of the footage is astounding. You know, yeah. And you know how big a football, typical football stadium is, you know, but you can zoom right in high definition, high clarity. I mean, they're amazing systems. So, you know, they may maybe not got something in as high as quality as that, but, you know, high quality cameras and cost next to nothing these days, do they?
Yeah, yeah. And it's very easy to install. It's not that you need, in the past you would have needed like a technical person, but now, you know, it's not too difficult, especially if you're going to use that kind of like over Wi-Fi or whatnot. So, yeah, I just don't understand how they come to this decision, where this would be a smart idea.
Yeah, so back to Kathy's point. So, you know, what should happen about that? You know, the employees maybe feel intimidated, you know, that they can't complain, otherwise they'd be, you know, out of their ear or something. But, you know, if they're not getting any joy with the employer, then they ought to be really reporting this to the ICO. But what's the ICO going to do?
Yeah, that's the problem, isn't it? You know, it would be different if the ICO were seen to do a lot of, like, you know, a lot of action. Even if it were to be investigated and possibly not really a fine as much, but a mandate that they must change their approach, and, you know, they'll do an audit in 6 months. And, you know, if they haven't done the changes, then they could look at doing the fine. But yeah, I think what you're trying to really say is what, you know, what safeguarding policies are in there, what whistleblowing policies.
Well, yeah, if it was a sufficiently large number of employees made the same complaint or signed the same complaint to the ICO, again, they would have to trust the ICO to keep that information anonymous. Or somebody could send it in anonymous and say, you know, there's 53 employees have prepared to sign this, but won't because they're worried about anonymity and so on and so forth. But I mean, there must be some recourse at least. You know, people have got to make a complaint.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be it definitely will be interesting, and maybe we might see some more, you know, like to teeth around this. We might see the ICO change, but, you know, with this new bill that's possibly coming through. But again, I don't think
it's just watering things down, doesn't it? That does not adding any powers or improving things from my perspective.
Especially if you're taking away the DPO role.
Yeah. Now, that kind of links. We've got another few stories about compensation, which I don't know if we have time to talk about everything today. But again, this could be quite interesting in the context of compensation. So the compensation, this is the Austrian. We talked about how ostrich post, haven't we? Ostrich post. I don't mean birds. I mean, as in the country Austria. But the European Court of Justice has made a decision recently on non-material damages. And again, this could be really interesting to kind of step through at some point to think, well, you know, this is a non-material harm that's caused to these people. You know, it's distress, it's harassment, it's, you know, feeling surveilled and so on and so forth. And, you know, how much is that worth in terms of compensation? Again, I read a good article about that this week, and the suggestion that there's a table put together of the kind of compensation levels for various misdemeanors. But again, that's really quite interesting to think through how the court did about, you know, the fact there's no threshold, that in theory, like, you have a €1 worth of harm, you know, that you have to have this concept of there being harm or damage, and that being caused by the non-compliance.
It's interesting. I, from looking at things kind of like a legal academic head, I think that would be a useful table for the courts to have and not the regulators, just because of effectively, I think it starts to become a bit more complicated without having, you know, judges and whatnot being able to kind of issue the fines and whatnot. So it's interesting. I think it could be a massive headache, and how they get to that would be difficult.
Yeah, I think that the idea is that the courts would define these tables. It would be up to each national jurisdiction to implement whatever's appropriate in its own national jurisdiction. And the article I was reading saying it was basically kind of starts off by reminding us that there's two enforcement mechanisms within the GDPR. The first is kind of national data protection authorities, that can people can lodge a complaint with those. And the second mechanism is litigation, where data subjects, you know, sue or you know, for compensation. And as we know, there's lots of no win, no fee lawyers out there representing a variety of cases, including the Capita class action. There's now 2,000 people that have signed up for that, apparently.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. Anyway, that's kind of, to me, that's kind of semi-linked with this, you know, CCTV, if it's causing a lot of harm and distress. I mean, it's a smallish number of people.
I wonder if it would increase or decrease the reports. Like people reporting breaches and seeing fines, because I see this in kind of two heads. On one hand, by putting a number to this and saying, by you having this amount of damage and you'd be owed this amount of money, it might incentivize individuals to, you know, report these breaches to regulators. But on the flip side, I also see it from a corporate perspective, where they can say, well, actually, we think you've had this damage, so we're just going to pay you out this amount of money.
Yeah. I mean, in this case, it's not going to be about compensation. It's about infringing people's rights to privacy, isn't it? And, you know, really the employees and potentially the parents just want this CCTV taking down on the basis that it's unlawful processing.
Yeah.
And unfair processing of privacy notice.
Yes. Yeah,
What they should ask for is they should put a request in for all the data that they've got on them whilst she was in the toilets.
Yeah,
a subject access request. Yeah.
That'd be interesting, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it'd be quite tricky to do, wouldn't it? Or redacting out.
Well, they've got CCTV, so that they'd have a problem, really, wouldn't they? They've created themselves.
Have a responsibility, yeah. Yeah. Now Martin's made a good comment. I'm just going to pick up on this in the chat, because it happened a long time ago. So he's. I was reading through it. It's a very strange event happened this week on my local community Facebook page. Someone asking to help dictate a works meeting call and would pay for the service. This is kind of an old minute taking. But I think that's probably something that is there, isn't it? People, you know, taking transcripts and typing them up. I think that's what Martin's saying. I'm just reading it now, trying to get my head around it. But if you want to clarify anything, Martin, or pose a different question, then by all means do. I didn't expect the TCDV bit to go off on a down a bit of a rabbit hole.
Well, it's a CCTV, is it? I think it's always a hot topic, isn't it?
Makes it interesting.
Now I noticed another couple of breaches have happened this week. MGM Resorts, that's the film company, isn't it? They got a cyber attack. Everything went down, their booking system, their slot machines. This is you know, second time they've had a cyber attack, and it was reminiscent of the cyber attack on a casino in, I think, 2014, which the attack vector was a fish tank, if you remember, a thermometer and a fish tank. So they've had an attack. Now I think you highlighted earlier in the week the ICO and the National Cybersecurity Centre have signed a memorandum of understanding to work together on the cybersecurity standards, which I think is probably, a good thing. That's, again, surprised that there's not already something in place, to be honest. But
I think one of the biggest questions that I've had as a data practitioner is, how do we achieve, you know, Article 32, the security principle? Because it's so, I mean, I know it is designed to take a risk-based approach, and it is designed to be a bit more, shall we say, looser, to ensure that everybody, you know, is supported by it, or different organizations with different kind of scopes and sizes that they can kind of do it. I think, though, this guidance, if when it comes out, is going to be fundamental, though, for kind of smaller businesses, because I think hopefully it will give a bit more of a concrete answer of what is the, shall we say, the baseline of what security you're going
to have in. Yeah, I got a dreadful joke. I think Michael is taking over from David Holmes on the bad jokes front. Got any raw data? But you're right, I think, and we have recognised this, again, doing audits, you know, when we're looking at security. It's the piece where it's really, really hard to form an opinion, because the GDPR is quite clear on what it, I think, quite clear on what it wants, but that doesn't translate easily when you're talking to IT people about what measures they've got in place.
Yeah, and I've been kind of like doing a bit of my own personal time looking into different like kind of ISO standards and different just security standards, and you know, like when you talk about like kind of cyber essentials, the ISO kind of references that as like one of the basic fundamental schemes you can achieve. You've got, you know, ISO 27001, and then you've also got what is it, PIM, so Privacy Information Management System 27701. You've got, I believe it's being phased out, but the BS 10012 standard as well, which was directly meant to be there to support kind of GDPR. But whenever I've spoken to you know, IT professionals, these kind of schemes, they don't see it kind of gelling in with GDPR, and it is bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, we've just commissioned a training program. I have to say it's for us internally, but again, people might be interested in looking at it, where it's kind of like security for GDPR, or you know, GDPR, you know, what is security. And we're putting a lot of thought into bringing together all the experiences we've had, particularly from auditing and looking at you know, other security standards like 27001 and the PCIDSS. And we want to try and bring that, wrap that up into a training program. You know, like it's probably going to be, you know, at least a half a day, where we can actually make some progress about assessing security against the language of the GDPR and the way that the GDPR frames it. So we're working with somebody on that. Ross, our training manager, is developing that out. We're gonna, I think, run it, Kathy, correct me if I'm wrong, in a couple of weeks internally, just to,
We
you know.
are, yes, that's exactly right. And obviously, then we're going to open it up to the public because obviously it's an area that most people get confused about.
Yeah, it's not so much confusing. I think it's just really hard to I think to apply. So, you know, like the PCIDSS takes a kind of a stratified approach. You know, it looks at network security and device security and application security and the environment security and, you know, measures to protect data and resilience and things like that. And the GDPR starts off by saying, you know, implement measures appropriate to the risk. So, you know, when we're looking at auditing, we say, well, what risk assessment process have you got in place for, you know, for these types of risk? And, you know, but it says protect data through pseudonymization and encryption where necessary. So, you know, we have to extend that out to think, well, what data have you got? Where, how's it being processed? What's it for? What's the harm it could present? And how is it being protected? You know, and that's from access control systems to multi-factor authentication to everything. So what we want to try and do is really expand out what the GDPR says into something that's far more practicable for people like us who don't necessarily, you know, do cybersecurity to you know, to the extent that our IT colleagues do.
Yeah, and I definitely think one of the barriers to that is the different languages that are used. I mean, when you look at PCI, nowhere else I see they talk about merchants in that kind of context, which I can understand why, but I always find that it's the wording, and you can kind of expand that from IT to different departments and whatnot. You know, what's different to like contractors and whatnot. I think that's one of the biggest difficulties that GDPR has, is that the specific wording is difficult by nature, I find.
Yeah. So what did you make of this announcement then, the ICOM and the NCSC MOU? So it looks like they're trying to put in place, kind of trying to codify and enhance working. Is that just between them, or is that, you know, to help the likes of us?
I think the purpose of it is to kind of help, you know, everyone. But I think
Oh, I
what we'll
don't know if I've
find.
dropped off the have I
Oh,
dropped off the thing?
no, I can hear you. Hello?
All right. Somebody dropped off. Might be me, or might be you.
No, as I was saying though, I think it's going to be really useful. I think it's going to be really good. I think that the intention is going to be for everyone. I think what we'll find though is that they will scope it out, because I think you can't have a one size fits all approach to security. It just doesn't work. And I think what we'll find is probably it's going to be most beneficial to kind of small, medium businesses, and then possibly we'll look at bigger organizations. But I think what they'll probably do then is just say, here are a load of like you know, cyber certifications and standards, pick one of them. I think that's what we'll see. I don't know, what about you? How do you think it will go?
I don't know, because I don't really understand what it is they're going to be doing, if I'm being honest. I have to have a look at it. You know, they're going to develop cybersecurity standards and guidance. You know, they I think going to try and help the ICO, the ICO's own cybersecurity. I think that was my reading of it, rather than, you know, creating something that's going to be particularly useful for practitioners. But maybe I've misread it.
To be fair, it's the ICO, so they, you know, say one thing and something else happens.
Yeah. Now, there's been a couple of changes. I mean, Vicky highlighted something which initially I thought, oh, this is juicy, during the week, which is that the definition of the fundamental rights and freedoms in the UK GDPR is changing, or in fact, has it changed, or is it changing? I can't remember.
I think it's changing.
Yeah. So via a statutory instrument, the Data Protection Fundamental Rights and Freedoms Amendment Regulations 2023. So I thought, oh, this is interesting. So let's see what this is all about. But it turned out to be not an awful lot. It's just moved the definition from being rooted in European law to Human Rights Act.
Yeah. It's so effectively what they've done is they've, from what I, when I did the kind of reading on it, is they have removed the part where it says you'll have fundamental rights, like right to privacy, out of the legislation, or you know, the data protection kind of regulation 2023. And I think that's quite interesting because they kind of insinuate that this is already kind of protected under the right to privacy. Now, just to kind of explain, well, I think this is a bit of a weird move. The right to privacy is, in human rights terms, is a qualified right. You don't have that right automatically. That's reserved to the right to life, right to education, the right to a fair trial. So it's a bit of a bizarre thing to say, well, this is going to be covered in an area that isn't always going to be applicable. And typically what we'll see is jurisdictions implement their own right to privacy. And this is why we have a bit of a cultural difference between EU and US, whereas in Europe, everything's private unless you make it public. And in America, everything's public unless you make it private. Both of them achieve the right to privacy, just in different contexts. And what we're seeing here is the government's kind of saying, well, no, this one little kind of key bit, we're just going to move this over. It's already covered by under this, you know, Human Rights Act. That's how we've kind of, that's how we've kind of tried to protect it. And I just feel like they're trying to give themselves more wiggle room. And especially if you, you know, if you've been into the news, they're trying to redefine or rewrite the Bill of Human Rights in the UK.
Yes, as well. That's the other angle on this, isn't it?
Yeah. So I feel like this is a deliberate intention to water down.
God, you are a cynical. I didn't read like that. So I thought it was simply changing the definition of rights and freedoms, fundamental rights and freedoms, from being rooted in European law to being rooted in the Human Rights Act. Because, of course, the Human Rights Act only applies to public authorities. Mm. It doesn't apply to anybody else. And you know, the European Convention on Human Rights is also kind of a similar definition, Article 8 stuff. But you're right to highlight the Bill of Freedoms, you know, the Bill of Rights, because if that changes, then again, that definition will shift and go with it, won't it?
Just to add to that, I could be completely wrong. I am taking a bit of a cynical approach, but I could be completely wrong, because they could actually redo the Bill of Rights and actually enforce the right to privacy. So there is a world where it could be stronger. Not saying that will happen, but, you know, there's a possibility.
Yeah. Yes, interesting. And the other thing that I actually done quite a bit of work on this week as well is this new... I mean, I like, you know, the fact that this all falls within the branch of, I call it, information rights law. Mm. So this is the Access to Information Scheme for Registered Social Housing Providers, which has been introduced under the Social Housing Regulation Act, which, of course, was the social housing kind of reform bill that we've been rabbiting on about for a couple of years. So under the Act, there's a requirement to have a FOIA-esque type of arrangement with a publication scheme and also a right to request information. And there's like 8 or 9 categories of information that, well, currently the way the working party information reads, it's only tenants who've got access to these rights. But that doesn't make sense to me. It must be more of a public right. Otherwise, how do you assess whether you want to fall under a tenancy of a social housing provider? So Kathy and I have been doing a lot of work on this with a couple of our colleagues in housing associations to figure out, well, you know, what does this mean? You know, how is that going to, you know, come into fruition? Because it's not yet fully formed, isn't the scheme? There's quite a lot of consultation of working parties going on. As far as I know, it's not fully reformed. And I've reached out to the Levelling Up department who is running this thing, asking for further information. And I've not yet had a sensible response. But if it is a FOIA-esque type arrangement, when the FOIA first was introduced, you will remember that there was 8 years leading time.
Yeah.
8 years.
because I believe it was originally called, like, what was it, Your Right to Know Bill or something like that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Back when it was proposed in, like, the 1993 or 1994 or something like that. So I do think this is a good change, you know, giving people the ability to kind of ask for particular information.
Dive in, Rebecca, dive in.
But I think the scope is, you know, yeah, might need a bit more defining.
Hiya, thanks, Philip. thanks very much for discussing this. I actually mentioned this to Miles during the week, and so it's great that that's come into the
chat. Right, okay.
Thank you. I'm exactly in that position of a housing association, and we're wondering what effect this will have on us, basically. My understanding is that it's post-Grenfell, and it's all to do
with the
inability or the difficulty for tenants specifically to get information from their landlords. And I had a quick look at the kinds of things the working party had been looking at, because I'd got the impression as well that that's where it is at the moment. And it was a little bit worrying in the sense of in terms of the list that they were coming up with, because it was things like, you know, people's names and job titles, fair enough, maybe, but also their salaries, their bonuses, very personal information. And you just wonder how far that quest for data, which is absolutely what we all want in terms of anything post-Grenfell and anything that would pose a risk to any tenant, and how far that extends then into the personal data of staff and where the reasonable lines are and what's likely to happen, basically.
Usually, I think, if I'm wrong, Christian, I think you've got better working knowledge than I have of the FOIA, is that there's a kind of a level in the organisation where that information is deemed to be, should be in the public domain, and below that level then it's not, and it's kind of like senior posts and I'm waiting for Tris to jump in and correct me.
No, you are, I think, correct. Just to kind of add on, so the way that education, NHS, I believe councils and maybe the police force, they typically do it by grade or band. So what they'll say is that, I don't know, let's just, I'm going to use you as an example, Phil. Phil, you're on a grade, say, 8-9, which is fairly high. That salary is, I don't know, like 60K, but your job role, and you could be on a different spinal point on that. So it could be like, you know, grade 8.1, 0.2, 0.3, whatever. So that's the way, and that needs to be made public. That's part of the publication scheme. And by law, that has to be made public. So it is interesting, though, that they've taken that approach, which is for public authorities, for taxing, you know, for effectively taxpayer money, and applied that now, or possibly are going to apply that to the housing sector.
Yeah.
Your social now,
I appreciate your concerns, Rebecca, about the kind of the personal nature of some of the data, but I was much more thinking about the actual process of finding the stuff to publish. So, you know, we're looking at contract awarded, what you're spending money on, business plans, policies, inspection outcomes and ratings. So I was stepping through again with some colleagues in housing association, said, well, how are you going to find this stuff? You know, you imagine the process. You've got to have this in a publication scheme, then you've got to respond to requests. We've got to know what it is in the first place, which means reviewing a significant proportion of all your data. No wonder there's an 8-year lead-in time on the FOIA. I mean, I wonder how much lead-in time we'll get on this, because, you know, basically, I mean, there's better tools now than 2000, but to me, it meant somehow you got to review all the information you've got, catalogue it, categorise it, mark it if it's in the publication scheme or subject to disclosure, and then you got to review it, because there'll be exemptions and there'll be stuff that is in that stuff that is exempt from disclosure or not even covered by the rights to information. So that is a massive, massive piece of work. So we're gearing ourselves up to help people with that massive, massive piece of work. Because, you know, I absolutely get where you are on the, you know, this is quite personal stuff. But I'm thinking about, well, how the heck are we going to get to a point where we've got all that information of all those different types, you know, into a addressable database so that it forms part of a searchable publication scheme?
Yeah, well, be very grateful to hear anything you find out.
I was just praying then that you had that the call hadn't gone silent because you jumped out the window.
No, I'm not quite at that point. I'm on the ground floor. I'm okay.
Right. That's design. Management is put down there deliberately. Make sure all the data protection folk are on the ground floor. Yeah, so we're going to come back to that.
We'll be in touch when we get a bit more information with everybody.
We will keep coming back to that, because that is, you know, our business is all about helping people with information rights law and certain cybersecurity schemes. And this is information rights law that affects a sector we're, you know, quite well established in. So we will definitely be trying to put together And we've got a number of really interesting ideas we're exploring at the moment about how you actually would go through that cataloging process. So, you know, not wanting to give too much away at this point, but you know, we're working on it and we'll keep talking about it. And we'll probably have a whole session on it fairly shortly about, you know, well, what does it mean? What have we got so far? But, you know, I'm still waiting to hear back from the Department for Levelling Up, exactly where they are with it and timeframes for introduction and stuff like that. But thank you very much for raising that. Now, it's now 31 minutes past, Tris. Have we got anything else we need to talk about? Or should we let people get to their sandwiches?
I think we should let people get to their sandwiches.
There was a few other things we had to highlight to talk about, but we'll probably put them into next week, unless, of course, there's a load of other stuff. Niles and I have talked about. So we prepared some notes for this session of these types of things, references to the stories. And we thought that might be something that maybe we should, you know, share out to people after the event so they can follow up on the stories. Don't know. Most of it is other people's you know, stories. We just talk about them and referencing them. But yeah. Anyway, without further ado, then we'll let you go back to your soup and sandwiches. Thank you very much, Tristan. It's always absolute pleasure to get you on and, you know, get your perspective. You usually ring me on a Friday evening and we can talk for England about absolutely nothing. So so thank you for that. And thank you, everybody else, for joining us and posing those questions and throwing those bits in. And thanks for the great jokes, Michael. We look forward to getting more of those in the future. Have a great weekend, everyone. Next week, I think we're talking about leadership, aren't we, Miles?
Elevation of data protection. And we've got, I'm going to butcher their name, Michelle Griffey, a chief risk officer at Communis.
Right. So that'll be kind of more of an interview and a chat style, I think, there. So that's next week. In the meantime, have a great weekend and we look forward to seeing you soon.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you. Have a great day. Bye-bye.